G'day, welcome. It's great to have you here at City Church. I've had a couple of weeks rest from preaching, and because of that, I got kind of a throat infection. I don't know how that works. It's supposed to be opposite, isn't it? That's what I've done for the last couple of days, in bed with a throat infection, but it's great to be here and able to speak. We're continuing our series, No Easy Road, and you've come for a good one. It's the Christian view of money. So if you're not Christian, you can just sit back and hear Christians be critiqued. And hear about a Christian view of money. But if you're not Christian, there is a little sting at the end. Let me warn you. Let me pray and ask for God's help as we get into Luke 16. Father Almighty, help us as we come to this topic that in many ways touches our lives so profoundly, even when we wish it doesn't. So Father, help us listen to your word well. Help me speak it truthfully and powerfully and clearly. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. At the end, we'll have a question and answer time as well. Just given the nature of the topic. Well, what is a Christian view of money? Well, your standard kind of response might be that Christians think that money or wealth is bad. It's a misquote, but I cannot tell you how many times I've seen it misquoted. And here's the misquote: money is the root of all evil. Sometimes people get it a little closer to the truth with the misquote that money is the root of all kinds of evil. That's a little bit better, isn't it? But it's still not quite on the money. But actually, the verse from 1 Timothy says that I'm going to stop using this. The verse actually says, love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Love of money. See, the Bible's view of wealth or money is actually that it's a good, good thing because it comes from a good, good creation. A creation, in fact, that was very good. And in fact, this passage actually tells us that money or wealth is a great thing when it is used God's way. But money, and that touches on the key point here, money or wealth is not an abstract idea. Money or wealth is something that we handle. It touches our hands. It runs through our lives. We have to make decisions about how we use it. Bank accounts, FOS machines, superannuation accounts. Every time you buy a coffee, every time you sign up to Netflix, every time you walk down the street, the clothes you wear, the way you dress, how much money you spend on makeup or not. Money. It's the fabric of life. See, money is there to be used for good. And during tonight, I want to show you what that good is. So we're going to look at that, and we're going to look at our money or wealth more broadly, or even resources, and the goodness they ought to be put to. And then we're going to have kind of 4 points that Jesus brings to bear to apply this passage. And then finally, I'm going to show you why the Bible warns us against money. Well, before we step into it, we're getting there, I want to make a disclaimer about a disclaimer. See, whenever there's, have you noticed on TV, whenever there's financial advice often on TV or radio, it's followed by that tiny little print down the bottom. Yeah, gamble responsibly. Well, there you go, money again. Doesn't it, what does it say, that tiny little disclaimer? What does it say? Yeah, terms and conditions, please check that this is suitable for your needs. Make sure it applies to you. Seek expert financial advice. You know, this is the greatest product on earth. But just check so you don't take us to the courts. Now, the temptation will be when you hear this passage that you'll actually want to apply a little financial disclaimer. Jesus isn't really speaking to me. This product is for someone else. Jesus' words don't really apply. You'll be doing your own little financial disclaimer, I think, as you hear this passage. But look at the very first phrase in the very first bit of chapter 16. Jesus told his disciples, if you consider yourself a follower, a learner, that's what disciple means, of Jesus, this is Jesus' financial advice to you. Don't seek other financial advice to try and step around this financial advice. This is Jesus' financial advice to you. And if you're not Christian, well, enjoy the ride. until the end, when Jesus has words for you as well. Well, it's a very simple story. There's a rich man. He's so wealthy that he has someone actually managing his finances. He employs a manager, an accountant. Let's call him Fred. Fred's dodgy. And Fred's dodginess, this dodgy manager, his dodginess is found out, and he's going to be fired. He's like an Australian tycoon. The writing is on the wall. The game is up. Verse 3. So he's called in. He has to give an account. He's going to be kicked out of his job. Fred, the dodgy manager, look what he says to himself in verse 3. What shall I do now? My master, my boss, is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. He says, manual labor, I'm just not up for it. He's not strong enough to be a tradie. Begging on the street in front of his friends or his family, it's just too shameful. He can't bring himself to do that. He is a man without a future. In the ancient world, there's no kind of superannuation plan. There's no government support. It's no income, no food, no life. It's that simple. He has no future that he can see. But then, Eureka, verse 4, he says, it's kind of the text says, I know what I'll do. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job, people will welcome me into their houses. Fred has got it. He's worked out what he needs to do to ensure his future. And it's very simple. It's a cunning plan. It's an excellent plan. He gets people who owe his current boss money, and he brings them in and he gets them obligated to him. Verse 5, look what he does. So he, Fred, called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? And different translations have different amounts. I'm not quite sure why, but 600 gallons of olive oil, the guy replies, which is a lot. And Fred tells him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. And then he asks the other person who owes his boss money, how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat. He said, take your bill and make it 800. Do you see how Fred makes the people who are in debt to his boss? See what he's done? Do you see how he uses the situation? He's very shrewd. He doesn't, what does he do? He gives them, look at the text carefully. He says, take your bill and you cross out the amount on it. And you write in the new amount. And actually, in the original language, he actually gives he says, what does it say? He gets them to read the bill themselves. So when they come up with the amount, it's because they've read it off the piece of paper that they owe, and they cross out the 900 and write 450 on it. See, he makes them complicit. He makes them part of getting rid of that debt. They've seen what it is, they announced it, and they get to halve it or discount it. He involves them. And this dishonest manager, Fred, he's made these two other blokes obligated to him. They know how much they owed, and now they don't owe that much at all. He's made a massive difference to him. Well, when his boss finds out what he does, look at his boss or the master's response, verse 8. The master commended the dishonest manager because he'd acted shrewdly. How does that strike you? Sorry? Odd. Yeah, but I think the point is here, it's the words are actually pretty strong. It's actually the word the master praises the unrighteous manager. And actually says he's a bad manager. He's done the wrong thing, but he praises him. Why? Because he's shrewd. He made the smart move. I can just imagine his boss saying, ooh, good move. In a kind of just recognizing the sheer raw audacity of it. You are going to be fired for being dishonest. So you used your dishonesty one final way to ensure a soft landing. That is a sneaky, cunning, shrewd, smart move. He's saying, you're smart, dude. If only you'd used my smarts for my business instead of against me. But the manager's saying, that's a smart, cunning move. Do you get it? He was going to be fired anyway. What's he got to lose? Nothing. See, the dishonest manager, for all his dishonesty, He understands the situation correctly. He's dodgy, but he's smart. Those debts that Fred got written down, he's insured his future. He's sorted things so he gets a soft landing. That makes sense? That's what he's commended for. He's just not for his honesty, but for his sheer raw cunning, shrewdness. I think what drives that point home is look what Jesus says in the second half of verse 8. He says, the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than people of the light. So by using that little phrase, people of the light, he's saying there is a good and godly way to act in the world, and this guy hasn't. But he's shrewd. He gets it. He's made the smart move. By using that phrase, people of this world, Jesus is saying, yes, the manager was dishonest, but he's smart. See, Fred and people like him, they understand the situation and make the smart move. See, Jesus commends Fred, the manager, not for his dishonesty, for his smart move. Think about it. See, what's his smart move? He had no future. So he acted in the current situation to create a future for himself. He recognized his current situation and used it to change his future situation. He read the situation correctly now because of the future coming. It's about the future. How can I act now because of the future that's coming? That's the smart move. Well, what are Christians like in this area? See, Jesus is talking to his disciples. What are people of the light like? Well, if that's what the dishonest people are like, they are shrewd. What is Jesus saying about the people? He's saying they're not shrewd. Christians are not shrewd. We are not so smart. Or to put it more bluntly, Christians are often stupid. See, what's the smart move? What does Jesus want Christians to think? Verse 9, I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings. The ESV says it kind of a little more clearly. I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. He says, use your money, which is part of this broken world, to gain friends for yourself. And see the connection with the story? Isn't that what the dishonest manager did? In case he used somebody else's money. To make friends for himself for the future. If you're a disciple of Jesus, what is your future? To be in the world to come. Not this world, the world to come. What's going to happen to this world? Well, it's going to end. Either it's going to end because you're going to end, or it's going to end because Jesus returns. But what's the future of this world? Again and again, Jesus says there is no future to this world. It's going to be wrapped up and there is a world to come. What's your future here? Like the man who'd lost his job, you don't have a future here if you're a Christian. Your future is to come. So what should you do with the wealth that you have? Jesus says, use it to gain friends for the future. Use it to gain friends for the world to come. So when it fails, those friends may receive you into eternal dwellings. See, wealth is good. It's part of God's good creation. How you use it can make it very bad, or how you can use it can make it very, very good. Now, Jesus actually calls it unrighteous wealth. And he's acknowledging that actually in this world, the money we handle, sooner or later, people have used it. And gotten it by ill-gotten means, sooner or later. The company you work for might not do the right thing all the time, but you still work for them. He's kind of recognizing that wealth in this world is intrinsically tainted. But the question is, once you've got it, how will you use it? Well, what does it mean to use worldly wealth to gain friends? Does this mean we should give everything away and then we have to beg? He says, no, use it to gain friends. Or, ESV, when they receive you into eternal dwellings. He says, the issue is about what? See, he's saying, use your money so that in the world to come, there's people who will welcome you because you help them be there. Does that make sense? They will welcome you because you spent your money in such a way as they heard the great news about Jesus and they went into eternity. And they welcome you to say, the way you spent your money meant that I've ended up here knowing Jesus, knowing God, standing in God's presence. So when you come in, they say, they welcome you. They say, you are my friend. Now, we need to be shrewd here. You may well invest your wealth so you've got more to give away. You might work with your wealth to plan, but the end of the game is, how will you use it so that it sees the great news of Jesus go out? That's the end game here. See, what's interesting in the previous passage, which is Luke chapter 15, there's religious people that are very angry that wealth is squandered on wild living. And that wild living is actually critiqued in the story of the prodigal son. But the temptation might be to think, don't be reckless with your wealth. Hold on to it. Be a Presbyterian. Be a Scot. Don't squander it with reckless living. Hold on to it. Luke 16, Jesus says, no, wealth is not for holding on to, but for using to gain friends in eternity. Use it so people hear about Jesus. Use it so people are cared for. Use it so people are protected. Use it so people are touched by wealth in such that they come to know Jesus. And then you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings by those very people. See, wealth is to be used, not saved forever, but spent for salvation. Now, I want to draw this out with a bit of application with one point and two questions that Jesus makes. See, the amount is not important. The principle is. The amount is not important. The principle is. Look at verse 10. Jesus says this, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So just in case you got confused about the story, Jesus condemns dishonesty. But his point here is, whoever can be trusted with very little can be trusted with much. Here's the principle. With what you've been given, what are you doing if you're Christian? Are you doing all you can with whatever it is that God has given you? See, it goes to your character. It's not about the amount, it's about your character. Are you trustworthy with a little, if that's all you've got? And Jesus says, you're the kind of person, your character is that you'll be trustworthy with a lot. And vice versa. If you're the kind of person who's dishonest or not trustworthy with a little, well, you'll be dishonest with a lot. So what wealth do you have? Time? Money? Intellect? A home? Resources? Skills? Networks? Facebook accounts? Twitter accounts? Computers? Energy? What wealth do you have? And if you're a Christian, how are you using it to see the great news of Jesus go out? The amount that you have, the amount that God has given you is not important. It doesn't matter whether you have a lot or a little. The question is, how are you using it? What have you got and how are you using it to serve Jesus? For what Jesus wants more than anything is for people to know him. So why is that principle important? Well, Jesus then kind of asks two questions that put wealth in perspective. Question 1, verse 11. If you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? He's saying the wealth here will pass away. It's just worldly wealth. It'll go. It's gone forever. While in the kingdom of God, in the world to come under Jesus' rule, there are true riches. I think in this life and the life to come. But if you can't handle the very little wealth of this world, well, it's obvious, isn't it? Would God entrust you with wealth in the world to come? Let me put it to you this way. If I loaned you my beat-up Toyota Camry, which its internal ceiling is falling down, the back shocks are shot. You can, if you just go down a gutter, you can hear the back tires scraping. It sounds terrible. It veers to the right. If you took that car for a drive and you crashed it, would I lend you my Maserati or my Porsche or my Ferrari or my Ducati? Sorry? The point's clear, isn't it? If you didn't take care of my Toyota Camry, which is, it's rubbish, why would I entrust you? I don't have a Ducati or a Porsche or Ferrari, just in case you're wondering, or my Maserati. But you can say, oh, there's no way I would let you anywhere near one of those cars. But Jesus is making the same point. If you can't handle the wealth he's given you here, why would he give you true riches in the world to come? That'd be just crazy. Jesus isn't crazy. If you want true riches from God, the riches of the world to come, and the world to come will be rich beyond imagination, show that you are worthy of it by how you handle what has been given to you in this life. The wealth of this life is pitiful compared to the world to come. It is the Toyota Camry to a Maserati. Question two. Jesus asks, if you have not been trustworthy with somebody else's property, who will give you property of your own? This is another question that cuts to the heart of how we see our wealth and our resources. It's actually an insightful, searing question. See, whose wealth do you have right now? In the question, Jesus is saying, you don't actually have your own. You have God's. It's not your own wealth that you have now. It's God's. Every dime you have, every moment of time you have is somebody else's property. It's God's. Every skill you have, every ability you have, every breath you take is somebody else's property. It's God's. And Jesus is saying, if you don't look after God's property now, why would he give you your own in the future? That's true again, isn't it, in real life? If you lent someone something of yours and they broke it and you had to get it repaired, why would you then actually give them something to keep? You wouldn't. Again, see, are you trustworthy with God's property now? Time, money, intellect, your home, resources, skills, networks. What should God give you in the world to come? So why do Christians so often get this wrong? Well, because we don't believe the next thing that Jesus says. Verse 13. Read it with me. Jesus says, no one can serve two masters. Either you hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. We think it says you can serve both God and money. And that I can serve God by serving my money. But look at it. Jesus says, not most people can't serve two masters. And you're the only exception. Or some people can serve two masters. And you're one of those people. Look what he says. No one. We actually have to make that key choice. Will we serve God? And therefore use our money? Or will we serve money and use our God? That's the key question. And so finally though, and here's where it broadens out to not just Christians, there's a warning against the love of money. And Jesus wants to hear us because he loves us. He loves us whether you're Christian or not. So you notice what's happening here. In Luke 15, there were three groups of people. Jesus was eating with tax collectors and sinners. And as he was having a meal, there were religious people around him called the Pharisees. And they're all in this context of this conversation. And at the start of Luke 16, Jesus talks just to his disciples in that context. But in verse 14, the religious people called the Pharisees were listening in. Verse 14, The Pharisees who loved money heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. He said to them, "You are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of others, but God knows your hearts." See, here's the test for our hearts. See what it says in verse 14? The Pharisees loved money. So what did they do with Jesus' words? They sneered at them. "This product's not for me." See, because the love of money is so great in them, they cannot even hear the problem. See what he says? "You are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of others." They think as long as we spend our money in the way that the society or the culture around us thinks that we're good, then that'll be good enough. We do okay by our society standards. It's good enough. We're fine. And they justify themselves. But Jesus says, "God knows your heart. You can fool people. You can even sometimes fool yourself. But you cannot fool God. He sees your heart. God knows the heart." 1 Timothy chapter 6, which I was talking about, the misquote at the start, says this. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10, "For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." That love of money, that we think it will bring us peace and security. A couple of verses later, Paul says this, "Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment." Can we trust that God will provide for us? Yes, he is the one who did not spare his own son. And that is certain hope. Whereas wealth is fickle and uncertain and insecure. But see, money so easily becomes our source of hope for security, and it leads to arrogance. I'll tell you a case that's unfolding at the moment. You might have heard about it. Gina Rinehart. She's Australia's wealthiest woman. A mining magnate for Western Australia. The fund holding the family's fortune is estimated to be worth $4 billion. That is a lot of moolah on anyone's account, right? The trust was established in 1998 by her husband, Lang Hancock, with Mrs. Rinehart appointing a trustee. The children, four children, were going to get their share in September 2011 when the youngest child, Genia, turned 25. So much money. Sure as eggs, Miss Rinehart is going to share that kind of amount of money, right? She's going to give it out there. She's going to share it. Her children, her youngest is 25. They're adults now. They're going to look after the money properly. She's going to share it, right? No, she didn't. So three of her four children took her to court. Because she wouldn't share the money. Why? Well, she didn't want the government. The argument was she didn't want the government to get their money and for them to pay undue capital gains tax. Her children asked her for evidence, which she refused to provide, and court proceedings have gone on for 4 years. Jesus tells us these words because he loves us. The love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Money in and of itself, wealth and resources, they're wonderful. They're amazing gifts from God. But if you love them, if they are your source of security and protection and hope, they will crush you. Only Jesus will save you. Paul says this to Timothy. He says, "You men of God, flee from all this and seek or pursue righteousness and godliness and faith and love and endurance and gentleness." See the last phrase there? What people value highly is detestable in God's sight. See, my question is, are you wasting your wealth well? Can't take it with you. Are you making friends for eternity? Are you spending your wealth for eternity? Charles Spurgeon, a great preacher from a couple of hundred years ago, died. It's estimated in the last 20 years of his life, he earned $26 million. from his books that he wrote, from his preaching tours, $26 million. When he died, he had about, in today's standards, about $200,000 left in his total financial kind of dealings. That was it, $234,000 when it was all wrapped up. Yeah, as far as I understand. What did he do with... No, I won't do the calculation. But what did he do with $26 million? Gave it away. He spent $500,000 building his own church. Not for him, but so the gospel could be preached in London. He paid for orphanages. He funded ministry trainees. He gave it to friend after friend after friend in need. He spent his money well. He actually said, gold is just dust to a man who is dying. Isn't that true? See, Charles Spurgeon understood the situation. There is no future here. So in this current situation, use what you have for the future to come. Will you invest wisely? Will you waste your money well?